All right. My intention is to end off our study on the English Civil War tonight. We ended off last time when John Cook, the man who was chosen to be the prosecutor of Charles I, he was unlawfully arrested and unlawfully detained in Ireland and brought to London and was in the Tower in solitary confinement with a number of other people who the king wanted dead. He had his list of the people, Charles II had his list of people he wanted dead, and his minions had managed to capture by this stage 29 of the top of the list that he wanted. And like I said, that included John Cook. And with these men now captured with the goal and the intention in mind, you see the deep state starting to work to make sure they achieve their goal. And they start manipulating the visible system of justice and law. And what we see what these kinds of deep government do is control outcomes by sleight of hand. They actually are magicians because they want the certain outcome and they want it to appear in a certain way, but they're going to manipulate things. I mean, what do magicians do? They, in secret, behind closed doors, they set things up so that they can achieve a desired outcome and everyone says, wow. And they interpret it as this amazing achievement or as a just action, but the whole mechanism has been set up behind closed doors. So in the political realm, the magicians, the deep state, seek to legitimize their actions through public opinion. That is, they want their audience to see something different to what is actually going on. They want the audience to arrive at a specific conclusion about something, and they do this by changing and manipulating behind the scenes. And those who are watching the show see the exact outcome that the magician wanted them to see. And when the audience, for the most part, is just watching and not scrutinizing, then what has been seen becomes the consensus of what happened. And so that's how history is often written, by the opinions of many. Charles II wanted revenge, but he wanted his revenge to be interpreted by the public as true justice. And so the deep state, all its powers of manipulation swung into operation. So behind the scenes, their shenanigans moved the right judges into position, so they stacked the judges' positions again with diehard royalists. They changed the law and even made sure that the right people were placed on the jury. I mean, it went to that degree. They had the guys on the jury, they changed the law, they set up the court, they had the judges they wanted in there. And so this was all underground working and putting the skittles in a row. You see, they had to use the jury. The jury was something that had taken heart in the people, and so they needed to use the jury, but they realized this was a threat and a danger, and so they got the sheriff, they manipulated the sheriff who was going to be choosing the jurors and got rid of people that they knew were not royalist supporters, and so that whole thing was put into place. Everything would appear to be in order and transparent to the casual observer, but in reality it was nothing but a smoke and mirrors being used to give the appearance of justice. As Robertson put it in his book, the regicide trial required careful legal choreography. Having rigged the jury, the regime now had to rig the law. And so what they did, can you imagine, think about this, just if it happened in our own system, you had the judges and the prosecutors coming together in secret in order to formulate the indictment, the wording of the indictment, so that the prosecutors would formulate it in a way that the judges knew this couldn't be questioned. And so they were strategizing together to formulate the indictment. And so as Robertson says, at these meetings, the judges helped the prosecutors to frame the indictment so that it would survive any defense argument. They advised against charging the defendants with murdering the king because this would create difficulties for convicting those who had not sat as judges, especially the prosecuting counsel, Cook. Instead, the charge should be treason by compassing and imagining the king's death. To imagine the king's death now was treason, which meant no more than doing or saying something that might conduce to his death, just saying something. But treason had to be proved by an overt act. And in law, such an act had to be proved by sworn testimony from two witnesses. So they decided to abolish the ancient rule that served as the only safeguard for defenders of treason at treason trials. However, since the judges dared not openly abolish the long-standing rule of law, this changing the two witness law, what they changed was the interpretation of the two witness law. So they determined instead to pretend that the two witness rule was satisfied if one witness testified to one overt act and another witness testified to another overt act. This was obviously intellectually dishonest, because the whole historic purpose of the two witnesses was to get corroboration on the act that somebody was claiming was done. The judges also decided to discard the rules for evidence. The normal criminal procedure was that any conduct that was being charged, so if you had done something and they were going to charge that conduct, the particulars had to be included in the indictment. It's not lawful to surprise a defendant on the stand. Suddenly he's, oh, I'm being charged for that as well now. You can't just spring that on them. You've got to have it in the original indictment, everything you're charging him for. But in essence, what the judges were doing was promising the prosecutors before the trials to abandon the rule which permitted the admission only of relevant evidence and to permit them to throw at the defendant whatever mud came into their hands. They could do anything to just bring discredit. With all the behind-the-scenes business arranged, a grand jury was called. Important part, isn't it? It was called without the knowledge of the defendants. They were still in the tower. They knew nothing that was going on. The grand jury meets, and they were going to find out whether the prosecution had enough evidence to bring the defendants to trial. The premise that the king was absolute formed the foundation of the prosecution's case. And it claimed that Charles I was so untouchable that the mere thought of touching him by putting his person under any force or constraint was treason. Since the king was above the law, he could never be put to trial by any authority. So this removed the defendant's defense, which was that they had acted in accordance with legitimate law. That is, they had acted under a commission from Parliament, and Parliament's orders, according to the law, couldn't be challenged and overturned in a court of law. So the only way that Parliament's laws are changed is by Parliament. Anyway, that was cancelled off the bat. This is part of the speech that began the proceedings of the grand jury, and the man who presented this this case kind of headed up the whole prosecution. And the reason the jury was called was because of the execrable murder of the blessed king, who is now a saint in heaven, King Charles I. It is made high treason to compass and imagine the death of the king. In the case of a king, his life is so precious that intent alone is treason. And what was imagining? How would they interpret imagining the death of the king? The speech went on. It was anything which shows what the imagination is. Words, in many cases, are evidence of the imagination. They are evidence of the heart. I must deliver you the plain and true law, this person said, addressing the grand jury, that no authority, not the people collectively nor their representatives, have any coercive power over the King of England. The King can do no wrong. There is a rule of law. If he can do no wrong, he cannot be punished for any wrong. And so now that's presented to the grand jury as they presented. And then, so basically what the speech did was reversed all the constitutional gains from the last 50 years, where they brought in a balance of power, a check on the King. And moreover, they had introduced something here that a man's words had never been regarded as sufficient for a conviction of high treason, but now it was. This is how the speech closed. Imagine you were a juror sitting on the bench getting this speech. You are now to inquire of blood, of royal blood, of sacred blood, blood like that of the saints. This blood cries for vengeance, and it will not be appeased without a bloody sacrifice. He that conceals or favors the guilt of blood takes it upon himself, willfully, knowingly takes it upon himself. You don't find us guilty, these people guilty, you're going to receive the blood on yourself. So as Robertson says, the grand jurors had been warned if they refused to indict men so patently guilty of shedding the king's blood, they would themselves be guilty of treason. And so the jurors quickly arrived at the desired conclusion, and the court was adjourned. The prisoners then were informed at 9 p.m. that night that the grand jury had sent them to trial for treason and that they had to plead to the indictment in the morning. They still hadn't seen the indictment. They'd been offered no counsel. They had nothing. So 6 a.m. the next morning, they were taken and marched to the place where the trial was going to take place, and they were allowed to respond only with guilty or not guilty. No debate, no discussion. There's the charge. And when they tried to debate it, they said, there's the charge, guilty or not guilty. And if you don't make a plea, we take that as a guilty plea. And so then they started the trial. The speed of each trial, along with the utter disregard for law, is just stunning when you read through case after case. Because a lot of these men were judges themselves who were being tried, and they understood the law. You know, like Cook himself was incredibly astute. And you see, and they're bringing and they're countering the stuff. They're exposing the absolute lawlessness of what's going on, and they're just being brushed aside and steamrolled through. And it got to be an absolute joke where the guy's arguing his point and they're just brushing him aside, and then the guy heading the charge would turn to the jury and give them the signal and say, look here, you need to make the decision now, and there's no need for you to even leave your seats. And so they'd look at each other and then they'd give their heads, and the guy would stand up and say, we find him guilty. So that's how it was just progressing. John Cook and Hugh Peters, who had been Cromwell's chaplain, they were tried on the same day. And they were both found guilty by a jury that also didn't leave their seats. And before passing judgment, the judge said, you know, both of you, this undoubted truth, the rule of law is that the king can do no wrong in the estimation of the law. So that's the rule of law. And you both know this. Then the sentence was read to these men. You shall be drawn upon a hurdle to the place of execution, and there you shall be hung by the neck, and being alive shall be cut down, and your privy members be cut off. Your entrails shall be taken out of your body, and you, living, the same to be burnt before your eyes. And your head is to be cut off, your body is to be divided into four quarters, and your head and quarters to be disposed of at the pleasure of the King's Majesty. The Lord have mercy upon your souls. So Cook had been sentenced on Saturday night, quite late. Then on Tuesday was the day of his execution. People were being executed ahead of him, but Tuesday was his day, and the sled, or the hurdle as they call it, was just this wooden sled with wooden runners that had a pole in the middle of it, and you were chained to that, you were seated and chained to that. And hanging in front of Cook was the head of one of the other guys who had just been executed. So it was swinging in front of him. And now he's pulled on this through the cobble streets. And the intent was that, you know, you're tied on this thing and you're being bashed around, and your back is getting bruised and bloodied against this pole as you drag through the streets, through the crowds who are spitting and throwing stuff at you and cursing you and stuff like that. And so they were taken to the place of execution. Hugh Peters was a man who suffered at times from, if it's manic depression, and he had swung into one of those just before his trial. He was also very sick with flu symptoms and, you know, septic throats and stuff like that. But he was incredibly depressed and incapable of facing this. He was just terrified, but he was taken as well. Cook was the first onto the scaffold, and Peters was tied to a railing on the side. And the executioner then showed Cook the axe, as well as the fiery brazier. This is this thing with coals in, where they would heat up the tongs and these elongated corkscrews that they were going to use to disembowel him, and they were red hot, these metal objects. Cook then went up another ladder, my understanding of how they're describing this, to where the gallows were. So I picture, I could be wrong, but it was a scaffold which was raised up because you had a big crowd. They were coming to watch this ordeal. And then there was another ladder going up to another scaffold where there was like a hang noose and a hole in the floor. And so Cook went up there, and the noose was put around his neck. And then he gave a final speech, which was kind of a funny thing, just allowing that under the circumstances, but it was still a tradition that they allowed for some reason. I mean, there were guidelines. The sheriff kept interrupting him not to say certain things. He spoke very boldly, very well. He was very positive. I forgot to mention his wife, on the morning that he was going to the gallows, his wife was allowed to come and see him, and she was just weeping uncontrollably, and he was being very positive and assuring her that there'll be no tears in heaven. But Cook gave his speech, asking for the king to have mercy on Peters and the other guys who hadn't yet been executed. He testified to the Lord Jesus Christ, and he sent messages to his friends who were in the crowd to stay the course by quoting kind of obscure Bible verses, but they would have been clearly understood by his friends, to come on guys, stay strong, let's stay focused on what we need to do. And when he had prayed, he then stepped through this hole, and so the noose tightened around his neck, and he briefly blacked out, but the hangman was there, you see, it was part of the thing, and the hangman quickly cut the rope, and he fell down onto, I'm thinking, the scaffolding, I'm not sure if it was the ground, but anyway, onto the scaffolding. So when he landed there, the executioners, they quickly stripped him, and they bent him over backwards, and they cut his genitals off with a sharp knife, and these were now held up and dangled in front of his eyes. And he was still awake and he's looking at this. And at this stage, the captain of the guard ordered that Peters be brought closer to watch the disemboweling. So they brought Peters now right up close so that he could watch them cut the innards out of his friend. And the hangman, laughing, said, "Come, Mr. Peters, how do you like this work?" The hangman then pulled Cook forward and inserted his red-hot knife into his stomach, expertly twisting out the lining of the inner bowel. Cook was then made to watch as his entrails were set alight with a flaming torch. And so they would just pull out these entrails and just be burning them. And the executioner normally at this point ended the excruciating suffering by cutting out the heart. But he didn't do this because he wanted Peters to observe Cook in conscious agony for as long as possible. The stench became sickening as the entrails slowly burned. Cook finally expired, and then his heart was cut out and held up to the approving crowd, and the heart was still pumping. Then the body was beheaded, and the head was held up by an assistant shouting, "Behold, the head of a traitor." His body was then quartered, and each quarter had attached to it either an arm or a leg, and these were impaled on the spikes in the city gatehouses, the entrance to the city. The king had a special plan for Cook's head, which was tied to a pole at the entrance to Westminster Hall. And Peter's head was tied and hung on London Bridge. But it was amazing, you see God's grace. We've seen it at other times in such circumstances where people have faced such horrific deaths. But Peter's witnessing this horror had the opposite effect upon him than what the sheriff was hoping. I mean, he was just trying to terrify this guy out of his wits, and it completely switched him. By God's grace, he was suddenly strengthened. He said to the sheriff, "You have here slain one of the servants of God before my eyes to terrify me, but God has given me strength." And he went up the ladder unaided. He said a few inaudible words in prayer and was seen to smile as he stepped through the hole. And so he then went through the same procedure that Cook had just gone through. And then a little time after this, on the 31st of January 1661, the anniversary of King Charles's execution, Cromwell's body was dug up along with those of Bradshaw and Ireton. These men, still in their shrouds, were then propped up against a bar, and one of the king's judges condemned them, condemned the corpses. Then they were dragged through the streets in their coffins so that people could curse them and degrade them. And then they were removed from their coffins and hung in a tree until nightfall. And then they were taken down from the tree, and their heads were cut off, and their bodies were thrown into a deep hole. And the king, after the execution of all these men that had been on trial, some were granted pardon. I think there was testimony that they had given that helped the king's case, and so they were given pardon. But the king continued hunting down other regicides, those who killed King Charles I, both in England and abroad. Then he even hired assassins to hunt down others that he wanted to kill. And many people died because of this. And anybody that they caught later on, because there was a massive list sent out of all people who should report to be tried. Now, not everyone did. But the ruling was that if you didn't report, you were in that trial. And the sentence of that trial was yours. So at any time we caught you, we didn't have to try you, we just executed you because we had already sentenced you in that trial. And so many people died. One notable person who escaped being put to death, only because he had some important friends, was the poet John Milton. Although John Milton wasn't only a poet, he wrote a lot of good prose, and he was very much on the side and the mindset of the Puritans with respect to church and state. So he would have stood with Cook and Cromwell, but he managed to escape the wrath of the king. The idea that the heads of state were beyond the reach of any legal system remained in place until 30th of September 1946, when the judgment of the Allied Military Tribunal at Nuremberg declared that rulers were responsible for crimes against humanity. So despite we see this apparent complete reversal and probably even going further back after getting rid of Charles to Charles II coming, we do need to acknowledge and realize the death of Charles I was extremely significant in the cause of liberty. Robertson says, "The axe that beheaded Charles confirmed at its stroke the principles of parliamentary sovereignty, judicial independence, no taxation without representation, no detention without trial." And as G.M. Trevelyan concludes, "Never perhaps in any century has such rapid advances been made towards freedom." And so even as we know, our own history is very dependent on these very events that took place. And I dare to say that our future will remain very dependent upon these events that took place. So that brings us to a very unsatisfactory conclusion to covering the Civil War. There's much more that could be said, but I hope that was enlightening and helpful, because we're not too far away from the same kind of mindset and attitude in many ways.